started. All right. I'm Lou Pulsifer. I design games part-time. My most well-known game is Britannia, which is a long, good old-fashioned, well, not quite good old-fashioned war game, but a light war game. And 25 years ago, I had several other games published. There were about 20 years when I had nothing to do with the game industry. I was learning computers and so on. I have a degree in military and diplomatic history, which may tell you some of where I'm coming from. Matt, on the other hand, has a degree in creative writing, and he's in the RPG side of things.
I'm a screwball.
That may be true, too.
Yeah.
He's one of the guests of honor, and he's one of those rare people who makes a living at this. Most people do not. And you'll find, I think, that he's a little bit hyper. Well, maybe not this morning. He doesn't look quite awake.
I'm just trying to keep up with my children when I'm home, right? I'm just on that speed all the time.
Yeah, children. I don't have children.
Nope. I race around with five little ones in my house, and it keeps me going.
First of all, we're going to have a reality check. Well, let's ask a few questions. How many people here have ever designed a game to the point where it could be played by other people? How many have ever had a game published? I suppose we should raise our hands. How many think they have an insanely great idea for a game? Nah. Sorry, that's part of the reality check. Well, we'll see, you know. Every once in a while there is an insanely great idea, like Magic the Gathering.
Yeah.
Something that turns out to be completely new.
Once every 20 years or so.
Or Dungeons and Dragons.
Exactly.
But that's very, very rare. So you may have one, and if so, good, I want your name because I need some money. I was thinking a little while before we came in here, there are probably a few people who work in the game industry as designers who we would call wealthy. The guy who designed Settlers of Catan is probably wealthy.
Klaus, yeah.
Yeah.
He does all right.
Klaus Teuber, I think his name is.
Yep.
Reiner Knizia might be wealthy, but then he's retired anyway, so, you know.
And he works like a dog either way.
Yes. Yeah. He does what he likes, and he undoubtedly makes a lot of money, but he's had 200 games published. But your ordinary putts, I shouldn't say ordinary putts, the ordinary person who does make a living in the game industry is not going to be a wealthy person by any means. You have to do it because you love to do it. Now in my case, I count as a small business and I can't even make a profit. Because once you start putting in 500 miles to get here for this convention and 500 and some miles to get to WBC and so on, and then the hotels and this and that and the other thing, and buying pieces and so on and so forth, I spend more money than I bring in. Now, if I have enough games published, that'll be different. Now, Matt makes enough money that he's a corporation, as I recall.
Yep, I'm an S-corp. I also, for a while, fed my family to seven by myself, but my wife is now working as a school social worker.
Takes some of the pressure off.
Yeah, it does. Well, it's just the benefits more than anything else, right?
Oh, yes, that's right.
Since
that's right.
You don't get any benefits, and chances of you actually being able to afford individual health care that does not come with pre-existing condition waivers is zero. So.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the reason you have to have a spouse with benefits. Highly recommend it.
So most people have day jobs who design games.
So either have a day job or marry well.
Exactly. Well, that goes with
anything. Yeah, you can say that about anything.
Or already be retired. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
There you go. That helps too.
And many of the people who are involved in the game companies have day jobs. The guys who, let's say Andy Lewis, who's the acquisitions guy for GMT, is an engineer. And, you know, he makes a lot more money as an engineer than he's ever going to make in games.
Yeah, I've heard of a number of people who are trust fund babies and they don't need to.
Trust a farm.
Well, yeah, that's that happens. That happens.
Well, more power to them.
Yeah, some people are lucky.
I like having independently wealthy people float around the industry. It's good for me.
My point of view is always never expect to inherit anything and then you won't be disappointed.
There you go.
As I've heard too many stories of people inheriting, you know, arguing over an inheritance. And say, oh, we don't need that stuff.
Great
idea
for a game right there.
There you go.
Inheritance.
Oh, my God.
There's a competition. There you go.
Yeah. Alan R. Moon, you ever heard of him? Designed Elfinlands and Ticket to Ride, amongst many other games. Well, he said that if Ticket to Ride hadn't won the Game of the Year award in Germany, and you'll probably all know that the German game market is much bigger than here, he would have had to get a part-time job. Now, once that game won, he said, in a face-to-face I'm talking about, I'm not saying secondhand, he estimated that it would sell at least 250,000 copies. And I have no doubt that he made at least a dollar a copy, so that's a significant amount of money. There's always room for negotiation in these sorts of things, and when you're a well-known designer, sometimes you can get better situations than if you're not. If you're just somebody that nobody ever heard of, then you're probably going to get a pretty standard, simple contract. So we can talk a little bit about royalties. And the standard contract that seems to be most common is you get 5% of the revenue of the company, not of the cost of the game. So if you have a $40 game, the company will probably make $16 because they sell it to the distributors at 40% of the retail price. And then you take 5% of that, and that's 80 cents. Now, if you sell 200,000 copies, that's a lot of money. But it's very rare for games to sell 200,000 copies. Even in Germany, they have to win the game of the year. Otherwise, you're talking more like 10,000 copies. If you're talking about war games, we're getting down to 5,000 and 3,000 and numbers like that. Some war games are printed in 1,500. Now, when they're printed in small runs, they tend to cost more, and if they sell out, you know, in total, the company's going to make more. But nonetheless, this is not something that's going to make you a lot of money. Matt has had, what, 11 novels published?
11th comes out in December.
And I suspect that he makes more money off a novel than most people would make off a game.
That might be true. I actually make more money off
games. But you're exceptional. Yeah. Matt is exceptional that people will come to him and say, Matt, we want you to do something.
Right. I've been doing this for 18 years. So, I mean, ever since I got out of college, I've never had a full-time day job not doing games. Right?
Very rare.
Like I said, I'm a screwball.
If this company sells something on the internet, then they get 100% instead of 40%, and you'll get 2.5 times as much from that game.
Or if they sell it in the hall down here, too. Same
yes, thing. Because they're selling it direct, and there's no middlemen taking a big chunk out. But internet sales generally are a relatively small fraction of total sales. The companies that sell a lot of games sell them through game shops, even though game shops are an endangered species. And I don't know what's going to happen if the game shops continue to be more and more endangered. It would be interesting to talk to people like Fantasy Flight, who do sell a lot through the game shops. I don't know what their plans are. You know, games rarely get into Toys R Us unless they're published by Hasbro.
Hasbro, Playmates, Mattel, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Patch Products, they do stuff too.
Oh.
But it's actually the big ruling we had from the Supreme Court last week was the fact that manufacturers can now set a suggested retail price or set a retail price. They can set the price at which their products are sold at retail now, which has been illegal for 97 years, right, as part of an antitrust law, and has now been struck down.
Wow.
Which means that this just happened last week.
Uh-huh.
So then now manufacturers can now say, well, you're not allowed to sell this at 80% of anything less than 80% of wholesale price, or within 6 months, you can't discount it within 6 months, or however they want to work this out. They can do individual agreements with whoever they sell the games to as to what they can resell it for, right? And that is going to be finally what is going to help brick-and-mortar stores compete against the internet. Because a lot of times people go into brick-and-mortar stores, play the game, browse around, decide they like this thing, and then they go home and buy it, right? Because they can get it for 40% off or whatever. And you can hardly fault them for doing that. I mean, it makes sense from their point of view, but it kills the game stores, which is our best venue for getting new gamers into the hobby.
Boy, that'll really do a number on fun again and some of those guys.
Yeah, well.
Wow. Boulder Games and so on, yeah.
That's all very fresh and new, so we'll have to see how it all plays out.
Yeah. Even in this calculation of the revenue of the game company, they may subtract shipping from their revenue, so you'd be at even less than 40%. So we're not talking about vast amounts of money, and some of that is negotiable. But, again, it's negotiable for people like Matt. Rather than for somebody who's relatively unknown. And it's going to depend on the company. And we can talk a little bit about contracts here. The whip hand is held by the publisher if you want your game published, unless you are somebody who can say, well, you know, I don't need you, I can go to somewhere else. there aren't all that many board game publishers. And most of them actually started as vehicles to enable somebody to publish their own games. Fantasy Flight Games, for example, which probably most of you have heard of, actually started as a company to sell comics or distribute comics. And when that didn't work out, they published the owner's game, Twilight Imperium, and that saved the company. So while it didn't officially start out as a company to publish his games, that's what it became. And he still is involved sometimes in design, and they do a lot of their games internally. And in general, in the industry, a lot of games are designed internally rather than the company taking outside contributions. That's certainly true for Hasbro and Mattel and people like that in general, not always, but in general. Fantasy Flight tends to do most of their games internally, or they publish Reiner Knizia's games. Avalanche does a lot of their games internally, and so forth. Mayfair does German games. They don't take contributions. They take games from Germany. Now, Germany is a different kettle of fish. I've not tried to get contacts in the German game market. Have you?
Not really. I know some people there, but I've not tried to get published there.
See, Alan Moon has. Yeah. So he's sort of an honorary German, is the way Matt put it. And there are a lot of game publishers in Germany. They tend to publish a certain kind of game. They don't publish war games, because the game shop owners in Germany don't feel they should have war games in a family environment. The players are perfectly happy to play war games. This video war games sell just fine, but not board games. And I have run into Americans who will not play a game that involves attacking somebody else. They will not play a war game.
But we can beat them up.
Fair enough, if that's the way they want to do things, but it's a different point of view. So on the contract, if they offer you this, this, and this, you can try to negotiate. And if you have some pull of some kind, then you can successfully negotiate. I did with Britannia, but that's because the game had been around for 25 years, and this was a reprint, and I could choose who I wanted to have reprinted. But for a new game, who knows? That would be more difficult.
You can always walk away, too, if you feel like you're getting, it's not going to be worth it to you. Don't feel desperate to have your game published. It's better to not be published than to be screwed while you're being published. Right?
It's just like buying a car. If you fall in love with a car and you have to have it, you're dead. If you can walk away, then you can negotiate the price down.
Right.
The ultimate in a negotiation is to walk away. If you can't walk away, then you're in trouble. Now, your first game, you might say, oh, well, I don't care. I just need to get my name published, name out there, because then I can go to somebody else and say, yeah, I've had such a game published. But manufacturers have been known to mess games up real well. And if you think they've messed your game up, you might not want your name on it. You might not want it published. Manufacturers, by and large, feel that they know more about what they need to do than you do. And maybe they're right.
Yeah, they've been at it for longer than you. Probably have a lot more experience. They know what goes into print buying and sourcing and everything else.
And it's their money.
Exactly.
So you have to decide what you're going to do about that. I try to carefully pick publishers who are not going to follow things up. And yet, this new edition of Britannia, much of what went into it was fixing the screw-ups that had occurred from the manufacturers, putting it back to where it should be. And people seem to like it that way, so maybe I was right in the first place. Who knows? I don't have no idea what I was thinking 25 years ago. It's like I was a different person. Can you get published by Hasbro or Mattel? Maybe if you're him.
I'm sure you'd have a shot.
But most of the time they don't even want to know, because they have their own staff to do it. Mike Gray and Rob Daviau and I don't know how many other people, their job at Hasbro is to design games.
Yeah, Mike's got the greatest job in the world nowadays. He's been promoted to where he wanders around the world to different game conventions and buys games for Hasbro. His job is to pick games that he thinks are cool. Usually they're published games already.
Mm-hmm.
That means it's already gone through a gatekeeper. And you can just say, I like this. We'd like to buy it from the publisher. Or the designer beyond that. So it's a hell of a job.
Oh, yeah. So Hasbro's got people who work for them, and You know, they put out these new versions of Risk and these new versions of Axis and Allies, and it's the same people designing this stuff. They're not interested in you or me, or probably not even Matt in that case. They know what they want to do, and they've got the people to do it. The best way to make a living in the game industry is to work for a game company. But, I won't say best, I'll say the least stressful, perhaps, because as long as the company stays in business, you know you've got an income. Now, your income's probably not very good. But at least you know you've got an income as long as that company stays in business. Now, game companies do collapse. You know, Eagle collapsed. And it had nothing to do with board games. Their statement from the owner was that they put too much money into a poker software. And the market collapsed.
Honestly, they put a lot of money into things they probably shouldn't have. They did more advertising and stuff, marketing, than almost any other company of their size. I remember back when Mayfair Games folded, before they rebooted, I did an interview with Lou Rexon, who was the director of sales at the time, for Inquest Magazine. And he said that he could have taped a $20 bill to every box that went out the door, and he would have saved money over the marketing they spent. Now, unfortunately, I quoted that, and at the show, they were trying to sell the company, trying to buy the company from Darwin. So the guys ran around grabbing every copy of the magazine they could find before he read it. It's at a Gamma trade show many years ago. I guess they managed to pull it off because they bought the company from him. So. But yeah, I mean, especially if you got deep pockets. Like, Darwin's family had a lot of money. Darwin Bromley was the guy that did Mayfair Games. And, you know, they did things like they rented a train to take them from Milwaukee to Chicago for the release of Empire. Was it Empire? Eurorails, right? And figuring they're going to have a huge press presence when they got to the end. One reporter showed up. And it was for a local paper. So it sounded like a great idea at the time, I'm sure. But it was just a ton of money wasted for nothing. And they would do stuff like this regularly. So, most publishers don't have that kind of luxury. Right? They're trying to make money with every release. Which is good for you, actually. You want them to make money.
And they have various methods. GMT has that P500 method where they want actually about 750 orders before they'll produce the game. Because right. Then they know they have enough money that they won't lose money. They stuck their neck out a few times and nearly got their heads chopped off, and they won't do that anymore. They actually have 3 full-time employees now, but the principal people in the company have full-time jobs, and then they just do their work on the side. Columbia Games, which has been around a very long time, owned by 2 guys, and they both work out of their houses. They have sheds where they can store the stuff or a basement. So they have very little overhead. That's the way they stay in business. Avalanche. There's a very formidable marketing lady who keeps the owner in line and tells him he makes good jokes about it. But he listens to her and she knows what she's talking about, and so they don't take chances, and
Liz,
it works.
Liz is not a full-time employer there either. She's a consultant for them. Liz, speaking of formidable, I saw her in Chicago last year. She got picked up by the TSA for carrying a switchblade onto a plane that she had forgotten was in her purse, right?
She's a strange. She's a character.
And a half. She's a great lady. But
yes.
She used to be the head buyer for Diamond Comics back in the day too. So she really knows what she's doing.
So the companies can't risk too much, and when they're publishing a game from somebody they don't know, they're not going to go out of their way to deviate from their standard contract. Now, I believe most standard contracts do at least have clauses whereby when the game is no longer in print after a certain amount of time, you get the rights to your game back. I would say you should never sell your game whole or in perpetuity, but there may be occasions when you do, and I know Matt's talked about one where he was paid enough that he's just happy having sold it off.
Yeah, exactly. Now, most of the time, if you're doing work for hire, if you're doing a derivative game or an expansion or anything like that, it's all going to be work for hire. You're not going to own that at all. But if you come up with something out of whole cloth and present that to a manufacturer, like a board game or a card game, you should expect to own that, and you're basically licensing it to the manufacturer to publish, right? Same way as a novelist does that. If you're writing your own novels, all my novels have been tie-in stuff for like Games Workshop or Wizards of the Coast, right? So I don't own any of that stuff. But if I'm doing my own original work, I expect to own that at the end of the day, unless somebody's going to pay me a ton of money on top of that.
Another thing you want in a contract would be a clause where the game reverts to you if a certain amount of time passes and it doesn't get published. Otherwise, it can be caught up in the equivalent of movie development hell, and you can't get it back. And It's not getting published. What good is it doing you?
Yeah, contracts are there for when things go wrong, right? Everybody, when you first sign the contract, everybody's thrilled. The publisher's got great plans. You got great plans. Everybody thinks everything's going to go wonderfully, right? The contract is for there when things screw up, and that way you know what happens when things screw up, right? There's no animosity there. You just say, well, this is probably never going to happen, but let's just work this out right now while we're both happy with each other and talking civilly with each other, right? As opposed to a year from now when we're screaming at each other over the phone. Let's avoid the screaming by determining what's going to happen when these things go wrong.
Another question that will come up nowadays in contracts is derivative works and things like digital rights. When you're selling your board game, and let's say in the extraordinary case somebody wants to create a computer playable version that somebody can buy the game and take it home and play it on a computer, who gets the money? Or if it's played online on one of the pay sites, who gets whatever fraction of the money comes to the owners of the game? That has to be determined, and the determination will tend to be in favor of the publisher, because the publisher will claim, well, if I never published the game, then it couldn't possibly get to this point. And there's a lot of truth to that.
It should be a split, theoretically, right? But yeah, they do have a point.
And the publisher's in business. You know, the publishers generally don't want to screw you and don't want to get screwed. They want to have everybody happy so you can continue the relationship. But if you're a soft touch, that's your problem.
Yeah. Some are better than others about that. Some will hold your hand and help you out and do all the great things, or steer you toward people who can help you, like Lewis and myself, right? But others are just happy to say, well, if they sign it, they're an adult, they know what the hell they're doing, they read it, that's their issue. Good publishers will actually try to walk you through and say, this is what's going on here, and you should understand what you're agreeing to, so that you don't actually end up that screaming at saying, I didn't understand what I signed at that point.
How complex are the contracts typically? Are there something that you can generally sit down and talk out or understand?
Yeah,
or
usually. Some of the contracts you're going to need a lawyer for, right? Well, you need to read them very closely, let's put it that way. If you understand how to read a contract, and you understand how the industry works, you can read. I don't use a lawyer anymore. My father's an attorney, so I used to get free legal help that way. But I'd show him a contract. There are very few lawyers in the world that actually understand how the gaming industry works, and the time it will cost you to educate them to the point where they can actually interpret the contract properly is usually not worth it to you, right? There's a couple guys. Brian Lewis is a guy who used to be the head counsel for Wizards of the Coast, and he knows what he's doing backwards and forwards, right? But usually you should try to, since you're going to have more expertise than this guy probably, you should say, well, I'd like to have you look at this, see if there's anything outward here that's going to screw me. And then you should just read it closely yourself and ask questions to the manufacturer, right? Say, I don't understand this, what does this mean? And if they say it means this, but it doesn't say that, say, can we have it say what you just said? Because a lot of times people say, well, this is what it means. I'm like, well, if that's what it means, can I strike out this part here then, because that's not what you said? Because a lot of times the guy who you're signing the contract with is not the guy who wrote the contract, and he may not have even read it very closely himself, right? But the trouble is, when everything goes bad, everybody's going to turn the contract and says, this was what this said. At that point, the person you're dealing with may not even be the person who made the deal with you. It may be three editors down the line, right? Or it may be three levels up the line that you're talking to the head publisher. And these guys are not going to have the same relationship with you. So you need to be careful about what you're doing. When it's in writing, that's what everything devolves to at the end. So always read it as closely as you can. Treat it like a rule book, actually. Think about it as a rule book. If it's not in the rules, it doesn't exist as far as the agreement goes. I always say, I recommend consulting a lawyer if you can find one, but it can be pretty costly. A lot of times for these contracts, you're only talking about a few thousand dollars. It would eat up most of your profit to actually educate the guy.
What about foreign considerations? Does the company sell there, or do you have to?
That again could be part of the agreement. It depends on the publisher, right? Some publishers will only buy English language rights, which is pretty common. Some of them will buy all rights, and then will try to translate it, or they'll give you sub-rights. A lot of times you'll have a clause in there that says any derivative works, which can include translations, you'll get a certain fee of a certain percentage of what they get, and that might be a third or a half or whatever, right? And then it's up to them to go out and negotiate the contracts after that. if you're canny about it and you know what you're doing, you can actually say, I'm not only going to sell you the English language rights, I'm going to go over to Ravensburger and sell them the German rights, I'm going to go over to one of the Italian companies and sell them the language rights, I'm going to go to Hobby Japan and sell them the Japanese language rights. But you're a game designer and probably don't have the time or the interest to do that, right? So better to let them do it. They're actually in it for money, too. They're going to cut the best deal they think they can cut, and you'll get a percentage of that. So it works out pretty well.
And I can tell you, little things like that can end up costing you a lot of money. When I had Britannia originally published, it was in England. And the contract said that they got two-thirds of whatever profit came if they were able to sell it somewhere else. Well, they sold it to Avalon Hill. I'd submitted it to Avalon Hill, and they said, oh, games of that era don't sell. So the publisher ended up getting two-thirds of the royalties from Avalon Hill. Now, in the end, when Avalon Hill published it, they printed a lot of copies, I guess. I don't really know. And it worked out in the end, but if I were a person who regretted, I would have regretted not making it 50-50 or something like that.
And again, you may think these are all pipe dreams and why you argue over these points. And they say that to you. It's like, well, this is never going to happen. Well, then let's make it bigger for me. What the hell? What's your problem? Yeah, it doesn't hurt to ask. Most of these people, you know, they may roll their eyes after a while, like, geez, I got to take another phone call from this guy or I got to answer another email. But, you know, that's their job. They'll deal with it. It's not that big a deal. And every publisher knows when they're dealing with a newbie developer or designer that it is going to be an educational process for the designer as well. Right? So, and they've gone through that dozens of times. They'll be able to put up with it. Ask questions. It doesn't hurt to ask questions.
And you'll get big companies that don't know the law.
That happens too.
With Fantasy Flight, when I saw this thing about derivative works, what I immediately thought about is, what if I make another game that uses some of the methods that Britannia does? Because a lot have already been published by other people. And so I specifically negotiated and put into the contract that I could make other games like that. But months later, people from Fantasy Flight were telling people that they had the rights of the Britannia system, and consequently, any game that was derivative of it could not be published. Well, that's against the law. The law is that you can copyright a game, and that protects the specific wording, the specific graphics, and so on. But if somebody changes that wording and changes the graphics, legally they can publish a game that's very much like yours. So by law, Fantasy Flight has no leg to stand on, but I know of at least three people in that company, including the owner, who were telling people, oh, no, you can't do this.
Well, publishers always do that. That was the stance of TSR and Wizards of the Coast for many years with Dungeons & Dragons, is that anything derivative of Dungeons & Dragons cannot be published, right? Nobody can publish their own standalone adventures, whatever. They would sue anybody that tried. They did several times, right? But Lewis is right. I mean, technically, these people were correct. In fact, going back to Mayfair Games, they used to publish a line called Roll Aids, which was generic D&D supplements. And Darwin, who was the owner of the company, had deep pockets again, and also had a law degree that he never used, right? Never once practiced as an attorney. However, he knew what the law was. So when TSR came after him and sued him, he said, screw you, I'll see you back. And they ended up settling with him and giving him a license to produce D&D products, right? And the reason was, they knew that if he won that lawsuit, it would basically blast the doors open for anybody else to do that. And then, you know, of course, Ryan Dancy comes up with the D20 system. Now anybody can do it, right? But what he was really doing is making it official. You really don't need that license at all, technically. But on the other hand, who wants to fight a lawsuit with a company like Hasbro? Right? I mean, you're talking about a lot of money over, you know, a role-playing game supplement that you might make a few thousand dollars off of. Very few people are going to be interested in fighting that battle. And that's what Fantasy Flight has done here. And a lot of publishers do that. They seem to, they want to, well, they tell everybody that they're trying to mark their territory, essentially, right? If they can scare you off in any way, they're going to be happy to do that. And who can blame them, though? But you should be smarter than that.
Mm-hmm. And movies do that all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a movie about Batman. Well, Batman's been around for ages and so on. Or say a movie about some historical figure, even. They'll try to... Arthur, for example. Now, I don't know whether the people who did King Arthur sued anybody, the King Arthur movie, but it's the sort of thing you'd expect from the movie industry. Oh, well, we have this movie, so you can't do this Arthur stuff. It's ridiculous. Arthur's a historical figure, but, you know, it's like people trying to own history. It doesn't make sense, but if you can have enough money and you can get into court, then you can do it.
Yeah, a lot of times, it's not a matter of who's right. It's a matter of who has the largest legal staff. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And because, you know, at the end of the day, you have to do a cost analysis that says, is it worth my time and effort and money to fight this battle? And that's a sad fact of our legal system. And that's how it works. If you're right and you win, often you'll get damages and have the other guy pay for your legal fees. So it can be worth it to you. But, you know, you need to think of these things out ahead of time as to what you want to, how you want to be spending your time. So a lot of times it's easier to say, well, screw it. I'm not going to do a D&D supplement. I'm going to do a game that's, you know, B&B instead of D&D. And it's going to be my bed and breakfast game over here. So, I mean, a lot of people just file the serial numbers off whatever the heck you're doing and publish it as something else that's close enough and recognizable. Don't go
there. So what do you do about intellectual property rights? When you write something or create something, according to current copyright law, you own it. You have the copyright. You don't have to register it somewhere.
The moment it's in a fixed format of any kind, and that can include a recording, a videotape, text, anything like that. Speaking over a table does not count, right? Because it's not been fixed. Nobody's got any record of it. But if there's any record of any kind, you automatically get some amount of copyright protection for that.
It'd be best to file it.
You can file it. It can be expensive if you do a lot of things. And the filing's not, it's like $75, I think, these days, something like that. I have never filed a copyright in my life, right?
Nor have I. It was $10 25 years ago, but, you know, inflation is everywhere.
Exactly. And filing a copyright will actually help extend your protections and allow you to get more damages if you have to sue somebody. But for a lot of things I've done, it's just not been worth the bother. And the chances of me having a legal wrangling over the things I do are fairly small. So. But yeah, you can file it. If you're going to file it properly, you know, U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, go to them and do it. Don't do the, you know, there's the old rumor that the trick is that you just send yourself a letter, a sealed letter with everything in it. That's crap. For one, all you have to do is send yourself a letter that's not sealed, keep it in a box, and then seal it when you want to, right? It's an old trick, but,
No, it's useless.
But it's unsealed. The post office will send you a letter that does not have if you don't bother to seal the letter ahead of time, if it's just like one of those little ones with the metal brad on it that seals it, they'll send that right to the mail. And then you can take it, open it up, lick it, put your stuff in there, and seal it.
You can steam open letters.
Right.
Nobody knows what they have or not.
And it's not a legal defense. If you want to do it properly, do it with the U.S. Trademark Office, a Patent and Trademark Office. A trained lawyer will pick that apart in seconds. They'll have the jury laughing at you, seriously. Mm-hmm. So don't bother with that. But again, I've never bothered to file a trademark or patent or any of this stuff. Actually, not even trademarks. Trademarks, you can just put a TM on something and you get some amount of protection for that. You know, it has to be a logo or something graphically identifiable, right?
It's SM.
You know, it's service mark is for that, right? But for a trademark, like for when we did Deadlands, we just did Deadlands TM. And you get automatic protection for that. You have to register, mm-hmm. then you get the circle R, mm-hmm. right?
If you put TM on it and it isn't registered or you haven't actually filed yet, you won't win it. A lot of companies do that so that people think, oh, it's trademarked and they won't bother with it. But you have to actually file.
Theoretically, you have to be in the process of doing it.
But if you put SM, mm-hmm.
right.
you don't have
That's a service mark. It doesn't apply to certain types of trade as well.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Patenting is almost never done with games. Patent is a certain expression of an idea. The Frenchman who designed Risk patented it in England, I know, although what he patented is not the game that came out in this country. But patents are very expensive, and they're specific, but they are, in fact, the only way to protect an idea, although it's only the expression of an idea. Ideas themselves are not protected. So, you know, many people sue about ideas, but in fact, ideas cannot be owned by anybody.
Is it true that WC patented the TAP?
Wizards, yeah. Wizards has the collectible card game patent. And one of the key components of that is the tapping of a card, which is any game that has a customizable deck that you can turn the card sideways in it. Which, coincidentally, is one of the great ways to get around the patent, right? You just have to design a game that doesn't have a tap in it, and you can usually get around it that way. Wizards actually just also announced about 3 weeks ago that they have a patent on constructible card games, right? Which are like Pirates of the Caribbean, mm-hmm. Pirates of the Spanish Main. Mm-hmm. They have a Transformer game that they just released, or about to release, that uses that same thing, where you take cards, and you punch them, they're plastic cards, you punch them out of styrene, and then you build little models out of it. They announced the patent for that last month, which, of course, WizKids has been doing those games for 3 or 4 years already, right? But they have legal records that show that they were designing that game and filed a patent for it a year before WizKids came out with their game. So they're going to get in a pissing match over this, basically. Well, part of the reason is because WizKids, because Hasbro is the master Star Wars toy licensee, and Wizards used to do the Star Wars collectible card game and the Star Wars role-playing game, which it still does, and the Star Wars miniatures game, but WizKids somehow managed to get the license to do a Star Wars constructible game. Right? So, of course, they're all mad at each other because they're marking territory, saying, you can't step on my toes, I'm going to step on your toes kind of thing. But this kind of stuff is exceedingly rare in this industry. I mean, we usually don't see this kind of thing. And it's only the 800-pound gorillas who are going to bother with finding that kind of stuff.
They're the only ones who've got the money to burn.
Exactly. Well, I mean, a patent can cost you anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000 just to file for that, right? And most, that would eat up the profit for most game companies for any small release that they're doing. So they're not going to bother with filing a patent in most cases. But, you know, if you're talking about collectible card game money, where you probably need, it used to be $500,000 to launch, and it's probably closer to $1 million to $1.5 million to properly launch a collectible card game with marketing efforts and everything else. You know, then $15,000 doesn't seem like a whole lot of money. Right, as a small percentage of what you're doing. So, I mean, you look at what Wizards Upper Deck did with their Versus system. They gave out $1 million in the first year just prizes that they were doing. Right, first 2 years, I guess. And Wizards of the Coast has given out like something like $25 million over the years as prize support for their tournament and league play. So, then these costs and even the cost that they pay a designer for them become very small. My argument always is, if you're going to spend $1.5 million on a TV ad, you ought to give me a little bit of money.
It doesn't work, though, does it?
What's up a little bit? I don't get $1.5 million, mind you. But.
This brings up the topic of licensed properties. You know, tie-ins with movies or books or TV show or something. You, as an independent designer, should not bother. They don't even think about designing a Batman game, because somebody owns the rights to Batman. They have their own ideas about what they're going to do, and the likelihood that they're going to talk to you and publish your game because it's insanely great is just really, 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 really small. Don't waste your time.
If you have your heart set on doing that Batman game, find out who has the rights and approach them and see if they're interested in what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Or what you want to do. Mm-hmm. For instance, Mattel has the master license for all DC Hero stuff nowadays, right? So you would go to Mattel and say, I really want to do this game. They're like, well, screw you. We don't know you.
Yeah.
But that would be your first step, actually, is finding out who has the rights. Because some people just get incredibly passionate. Like, I had a guy come up to me and want to do a Buckaroo Banzai game. I'm like, well, good for you. Then you got to find out who has the rights. And do all that before you waste your time developing a game that's never going to see print because of this. Because you don't have the legal right to do any of that.
Now, we could say, why do you design games? And obviously some people do it with a hope of making money and making a living, and they succeed. Many people design games because they have to, and some of them self-publish them. And you can see some of them in the exhibit hall. They won't be here next year. They sit there and, you know, occasionally people come by and play, but they're losing money. Some of the regular vendors lose money when they come here. You're going to lose money, almost certainly. But if that's what you want to do, okay.
Now, to put that in perspective, almost every business fails, not just game companies, right? You know, most businesses fail within the first 2 years. If you survive 2 years, you're doing really well, right? So it's not unusual that you'll see a company fail, but here you see spectacular burnouts because they're right in front of you.
You've all heard the joke, how do you make a small fortune in the game industry? You start with a big fortune.
Exactly. But, you know, I like to tell people, if you want to become a game publisher, think twice. Because, I mean, a lot of people want to publish their own game, right? They think that they'll get all the money and they get all the control and everything else, which is true. However, if you want, being a game publisher and a game designer are two entirely separate things. And you should figure out what you want to be. Because as soon as you become a game publisher, you will no longer have any time to design the games. This industry is littered with guys who are running companies that thought they were starting a company to publish their game and now are publishing other people's efforts. Right? And a lot of them enjoy it. I mean, the guys who are successful, that's because they got into it and they said, well, actually, I enjoy being a game publisher. Now I'm going to do that instead, right? But if designing games is your passion, then stick with that. I was a game publisher for 4 years with Pinnacle Entertainment Group. I founded a company. We did Deadlands, Great Rail Wars, Brave New World, a whole bunch of other games, and did fairly well. And then I said, you know, I'd really prefer designing games. So I'm going to go back to freelancing. That's what I do nowadays. But, you know, figure out what is important to you. And it may take you a few tries to figure it out. But try to stick with that as opposed to telling yourself that you're going to be able to do all of it at once. Everybody in a small company wears 12 different hats, right? But if you want to wear one hat, just put that on and wear it proud.
Now, given that, by and large, you're not going to make a lot of money designing games, you may still choose to do it because you want to be creative or because you like to have people ask you to autograph your game. That's kind of cool. Or you like the look on people's faces when they're playing a game and you come up and you watch it and they talk to you and then they find out you're the designer. That's pretty cool.
First time a kid asked me for an autograph, I laughed so hard he ran away. I was just shocked out of my mind that anybody would bother, right? He was like a 13-year-old kid, and I laughed. He was so embarrassed he ran away. And I'm like, you get used to it. It's the thing about being famous in the game industry is, like, here, I'm fairly famous. Probably many of you know who the hell I am and wouldn't know me on the street, right? It's great, actually. Nobody bothers you. It's very easy. Mm-hmm. But the guys who I want to know me, right? The publishers and stuff. These are the guys who are my buddies. I hang out with them. If I want to design a game, I just go to them and it's all set, right? But, you know, I don't have to worry about stalkers or people yelling at me. I've actually gotten death threats over games. If you believe
no.
Me. Oh, yeah. Like 3 or 4 times. I mean, it's mostly just internet guys going, Matt Forbeck should fucking die for writing this, right? And I'm like, you know, I'm right here. And usually they'll say, oh, I'm sorry. You know, cause they're just some idiot in a bedroom by himself typing on the keyboard thinking that he's just...
There are a lot of maladjusted people in the game.
Well, you know.
let's face it.
The thing is, the internet's a giant echo chamber, so you hear those guys.
Oh, yeah.
All the nice guys are just like playing a game off someplace and not worrying about it, right? But the guys who have an axe to grind are out there grinding it very loudly. But yeah, I mean, and that'll happen. I mean, most of the letters I get are just, you know, sweet people saying, thank you for doing this. I love playing this game with my kids. You know, that just makes your day when you get one of those,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm,
and then every now and then you get some jackass who wants to tell you how you've screwed everything up in his life.
Thank heaven I have not had that happen. I do occasionally get a message, even about some old, my first game, Swords and Wizardry, which was somewhat screwed up by the publisher. Mm. Guy writes to me and says, oh, this is my favorite board game.
Cool.
From France. Cool. Yeah,
yeah,
cool.
Exactly.
Just right out of the blue. You can't beat that.
A lot of people ask me about stuff I wrote 20 years ago, 18 years ago, whatever. I'm like, I don't even remember that. Thank you.
Yeah, and I used to write a lot for Dragon Magazine and so on, and I'll run into people and they'll know me for a while and they'll say, God, I was looking at all this stuff I'd say from Dragon Magazine, Lou, and you wrote 1/3 of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's pretty good, too. And you can think of it as, you know, most people have jobs and they do good jobs and they do good work, but they don't affect a lot of people. It depends on your job. When you do a game, you affect a lot of people, and all those people, we hope, playing your game and enjoying it, it's probably the most good you're going to do in the world in your life. I mean, it's not saving lives, perhaps, but it's not bad.
Yeah. I wrestle with this one. My wife's a school social worker, so she's out helping homeless children. I'm like, what the hell am I doing? I should be out, you know, planting a field or doing irrigation or something. I don't know. Getting kids off the street, but she's just great.
Optometry advertising.
There you go. It's all good, honestly. If you're good people doing good work and you're out there helping anybody out in any sense, I mean, even we're basically doing entertainment here, right? And even when we're sitting here, we're entertaining you guys in some sense, right? Well, hopefully. But it's worthwhile. I mean, I often think that if at the end of the day we can just start arguing about games instead of anything else, that's a hell of a world we'll be living in, right? So I'm okay with that.
Do you need an agent? Well, many people who are not familiar with the game industry think, well, I've got to get an agent and I'm going to approach Hasbro and Mattel and so on. And like I said, most likely the game you design is not one that they're going to be interested in, even if they would listen to you. So if you're going to approach them, you will need an agent. And there are companies that act as agents, and some of them are not reliable. The one thing you want to make sure of is you never pay an agent money until your game has been placed and you've signed a contract.
Right. Right.
If they want money up front, the hell with them. The same with headhunting of any kind. You don't want to deal with the people who want money up front.
Right. Those are scams, generally speaking. Right. Those are people living off the hopes of designers. So, and the same thing happens in the publishing industry and book publishing, too. They have a lot of unreputable or disreputable agents who do that kind of thing. But really, the rule is that the money should flow to the designer or the writer. Money flows to the creator. The pieces get skimmed off the top by your agent or whoever else, your attorney's on the way to you, but it should all go to you, and you should never be paying anything out. Right. Now, as Lou was about to tell you, you don't really need an agent for most of this stuff, though.
No. You know, it depends on your personality and so on, but you want to deal directly with the people who you're going to deal with. And again, depending on who it is and what game and so on, then you can do that. And it helps a lot once you become known in some way. Whether you've written articles for magazines like I did before I had games published, or you've been a volunteer in the booths, that's one way to get in touch with people, is volunteer in the booths at the conventions and talk to them and so on. Some way that you get to know them a little bit, and you're not just somebody off the street who's the same as anybody else. Which is not always easy to achieve. It sort of comes into another question. How do you become good at designing games? Well, you become good at designing things by doing it. And it works kind of like, perhaps kind of like this. Jerry Purnell, who's a science fiction writer, says you need to write 1 million words that you're willing to throw away before you will be good enough to be a published novelist. Well, in a sense, in games, you might need to spend a lot of time designing variants, mods, D&D adventures, things like that, before you get good enough that your stuff is truly publishable. That doesn't mean you won't get it published before, because in the game industry, there's a lot of dreck. Especially in RPGs, there's a lot of dreck, because you have fanboys willing to just write whatever you want, and they get paid almost nothing, and then you have PDFs and so on that cost nothing to produce. And so there's a lot of stuff that's not very good.
Yeah, the barrier to entry for the gaming industry has gone incredibly low over the years because of the publishing technology has become more accessible to everybody, right? The Macintosh and the PDF has become everything you ever needed. I mean, I can basically lay out and design. When I design role-playing games, I actually write them in Quark, InDesign, or PageMaker. Just write them as I lay them out, right? I just commission the artwork, put it all in the template, and then I can just hit click, and it either goes to a PDF, or I can send it to the printer. Right? And if you know what you're doing with that stuff, and it's not that hard to train yourself these days, it's fairly easy to become a publisher. Right? Doing it well, doing it properly, making money at it, those are tricky. But the actual publishing skills that used to require degrees to do are now something that anybody can pick up in their spare time, basically.
You recommend games that are less expensive, like the card game versus the board game?
I don't think it matters. And in fact, manufacturers go back and forth depending on what they have, what kind of games they want to sell. So if you see somebody who's selling only cheapy little games, that's the kind of thing you should pitch them, right? Like, cheap-ass games is not going to do a big freaking board game, right? Until Titanic Games comes along and decides to do the deluxe Kill Dr. Lucky, which happened this year, right? But that's a whole other company they founded just to do that game and games like that. But a lot of manufacturers would rather do expensive games, right? Because then, for every hit they get $50 as opposed to, you know, it's a lot easier to sell 1,000 copies of a game for $50 than it is to sell, 10,000 copies of a $5 game. Right? So it depends on the manufacturer's philosophy, basically. Some people, everybody's got their different angle on it, and you should trust them because it's their business, and sell them what they want.
And this works the same as applying for a job. People who hire people for jobs get a lot of applications where the person applying obviously has no idea what the job is, and it's a waste of everybody's time. And the same thing can happen in games where you've designed a game and you're going to somebody who just is very, very unlikely to publish a game of that type. You've wasted everybody's time. So you have to do some research and find out what kind of games they publish. Of course, when you ask them, they'll usually say, oh, we just publish good games.
Right.
they won't tell you what their preferences are, but they do have preferences. They just won't always tell you up front.
You can tell their preferences by looking at their catalog, really, right? But the thing is, every manufacturer is hoping for that shot out of the blue that's going to be the next category builder, right? So they don't want to limit themselves too much. They don't say, well, we only do board games of this type, right? Because you know, otherwise Magic the Gathering never happens, you know, Mage Knight never happens, any of this stuff never happens. So they want to be open to new ideas. But on the other hand, if it's an old idea that they know they don't want, then they're going to just, as soon as it comes in, if they're a role-playing game publisher and a traditional board game comes in, or a war game, they're just going to pitch them in the trash first thing. But go to the, every publisher has a website these days. Most of them will have submission guidelines on that website. Go there, download the guidelines or read them, follow them to the letter. Because some of the guys actually use the guidelines as an idiot test, right? They'll put something like 3 pages into the guidelines that says, on page four of your submission, it should in the upper left-hand corner write ABX43, you know, whatever gibberish. And the idea is that if they go to page four of your manuscript and say and don't see anything, they just pitch it because they know that you've not read their guidelines. So, and it, you know, that's a silly way to do it, but people do that stuff. So just read it, follow it. Those are there to make their lives easier, and because of that, it'll make your job easier, too.
One of the reasons they have guidelines is because they don't want to be sued.
Yeah.
Because your typical newbie game designer has this, what they think is a great idea, and they pitch it to some company, and they send it out of the blue. Well, the company happens to be doing the same thing because it's not a great idea, it's an obvious idea. And then the person tries to sue them. Well, it's silly anyway, because you can't protect ideas by law. Nonetheless, if they sue, then it's a pain in the butt. So many of these companies have particular ways that you have to do a proposal. You don't send them the game, you send them a proposal, the description of the game. But they require you to sign an agreement that in effect says, if we publish a game just like this, you have no legal recourse. Because they have to.
It's called a standard waiver, basically. And a lot of times, if you've never done this kind of stuff, you'll look at that and say, oh my God, this is just, they're asking me to let them rate me for just showing them my idea, right? It almost never happens. I know one instance where this has happened, and actually it worked out in the designer's favor anyway. And that was when a designer did the wrestling collectible card game. He pitched it to Comic Images, and then they rejected it, and then they took his game and developed into a real game. And then he turned around and sold that game to Wizards of the Coast for their wrestling card game. And when the two games came out, they were like surprisingly similar. And fortunately, Wizards was more than happy to sue Comic Images on the designer's behalf. And now Wizards and the designer get a royalty for every copy of that game they sold. So that's the only case I've ever heard of in the entire industry.
Kind of related to that in submission guidelines, what level of, I guess, detail and completion are most publishers looking for when you submit an idea?
When I submit stuff, it's usually, if it's a board game or anything like that, or a card game, it's black and white photocopied, or printed on my inkjet printer text, right? Doesn't need any artwork, doesn't need any of that kind of stuff, doesn't need any bells and whistles. You need to have a complete copy of the rules so they can understand what the heck they're looking at, and you need to have at least a mock-up of the components. They don't have to look like what they're going to be like in the end. You can tell them what you want them to be. You know, it's going to be, this is going to be a 10-inch tall mech that's going to bounce across the board by itself. You don't have to actually design that, right? But you need to have at least a piece of paper that represents where that will be on the board or wherever your playing surface is. So you can go pretty low tech with this stuff. I mean, a lot of times they'll just take a PDF that you send them, right, and they'll print it out themselves and just do it. I try to make it as easy for them as possible. I'll make the prototype, you know, print out, if I'm doing a collectible card game, for instance, I will print out the cards on stickers, slap them onto a regular card deck, and so they can shuffle them, and then send them the whole thing as complete as I possibly can, even with dice and whatever else is included. Because I know that anything that will stop them from saying, oh shit, I gotta print this out, and I gotta cut it up, and so I try to make it as easy on them as possible. But it doesn't have to look pretty at all. If you can make it look pretty, that's okay. But I wouldn't bother like hiring an artist or anything like that. In fact, for prototypes, I will often just, and this is perfectly legal to do for private stuff like this, you just take photos off the internet or anywhere else you want to find them and just dummy them in and say, of course, this is not for sale, but you just, like, somebody asked me for, a fantasy game at one point. I'm like, oh, just take Gandalf here and put him on this card. No, doesn't matter because it's not for sale. You're not doing it. You're not infringing anybody's rights there. You're just using this as an example. That's perfectly fine that way, and you can make things look pretty nice that way too.
You have to consider that in the pre-computer age, things were typed or hand-drawn, like hand-drawn maps. So computer-generated maps are pretty cool.
Yeah.
And computer-generated text is a lot better than old type text with, you know, whiteout and things like that. So things have improved quite a bit. But I remember reading once on Board Game Geek, J.C. Lawrence had been involved in playtesting some games. And he said the ones that actually got published were the cheapest of the lot as far as the look of the quality of the prototype. But they were playable, and that's what counted, is that was playable. I've seen people produce beautiful prototypes, and what I see is two things. One, they're wasting a lot of time. But, you know, maybe they enjoy doing that. And two, the more time they spend, the less likely they are to change it.
Yeah, I can see that.
And so I don't want to spend so much time that I'm reluctant to change it, because when you design a game, you're going to have to change it and change it and change it. I don't care if you're, well, let's take an example. Isaac Asimov. You heard Isaac Asimov. 300 books. Once, on a dare, he wrote a short story, first draft, and sold it. Now, that was Isaac Asimov, so it probably didn't matter what the story was, he was going to sell it. But in general, you're going to have to modify things. The better you get at it, the less you'll have to modify it. When you get to the point of playtesting, things aren't going to work the way you conceived, unless you're very, very experienced. And even then, it's still not going to work exactly the way you conceived. So you have to be willing to change the game again and again and again and again.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to throw it all out. They say you have to be willing to kill your babies, basically. I mean, because you're very attached to these things. Of course you are. You design them. You think they're incredible things. But as the old saying goes, no plant survives contact with the enemy, right? Mm-hmm. As soon as it gets out there in the real world, things are going to change. You need to be able to adapt to that. And that's perfectly natural. And you guys, you'll do that. You'll say, oh, God, that did suck. And you'll say, oh, but this is a much better idea. That's actually part of the fun for game design for me, is the revisions, because I can say, well, that didn't work at all, but here's another idea. And it's just continually refining things until you come up with something that's polished. And it's like taking, it's almost like taking a lump of coal and trying to make a diamond out of it, actually, but it takes a while. But eventually you get something that's really precious. See, I'm a writer. I'm doing metaphors on the fly. Actually, I have to leave. I have a seminar right next door I'm supposed to be doing right now. But thank you guys for coming.
You got 1 minute. Thanks, Matt.
If anybody has any questions for me, you can always write me at matt@forbeck.com, F-O-R-B-E-C-K.com. I'd be happy to help you out. I had a lot of people help me out when I was starting out, and I'm always happy to repay the favor. Good luck. Thanks, Lewis.
Thank you. But this idea of needing to change again and again and again is why the idea is pretty pointless. Ideas are a dime a dozen. There are very, very few new ideas. What happens in games is people come up with new ways to apply old ideas, old combinations of things, which seems new, and is new, but the ideas themselves are not. So you never sell an idea to a company. You sell a game. You have to have a game there. They're not interested in buying ideas. They got lots of ideas. Everybody's got ideas. They got ideas all over the place. And they can't be protected by law. So, who cares about your idea? That's the blunt truth. What they care about is the execution of the idea, which is the game that can be played. You can say that until you have a playable prototype, you don't have anything. You haven't designed anything. Once you have that playable prototype, then you can find out what's going to happen. Even in the video game industry, where they tend to arrange it, figure it out all up front because they're trying to sell an idea before they spend vast amounts of money programming and doing the art for a game, they find out that when they actually have a playable game, then they can really figure out whether they've got something good and they can change it. Firaxis, who does Civ 4, and Sid Meier's, they're especially into that. They want a playable prototype as soon as possible. The most fascinating part of game design to me is the first few times that I play a game, and I play them solo. You know, I don't grab somebody else and have them play when the game's not been played before. That's not fair to the other person. If the game's any good at all, then by God, I ought to be playing it solo. And some games are harder to play than others solo, but even ones where there's hidden information, you can try to do it and figure out what's going on and see what's going on. It's just harder to do. But, you know, I've always been kind of a game player to see what happens next. So there it is, a brand new game, nobody's ever done it before, and I'm playing to see what happens next. And then they say, oh, that's not good, we're going to change that. and I can change it on the fly, and I can stop in the middle if I want, and that's okay. I'll play a game several times, and it varies. I've played some as much as a dozen times before anybody else played, and in one game I think I played 1.5 times before I had somebody else play it, and it turned out to be one of my best games so far. So who knows? But I play it solitaire, get it to where I know what the rules are, and I have notes about the rules. I haven't got rules written out, because so many things are going to change because it takes so long to write the rules out. And then I'll try to get other people to play, people that I know generally. And then when I get it to a point where I've got a full set of rules, I'll have people play who I don't know or who are just acquaintances. And ultimately, the ideal is that you then send the complete game to people to play without you being involved at all. I try not to play when other people are playtesting because of several reasons. One, it can skew the game. Oh, he's a designer, let's get him. Oh, he's a designer, he's going to win anyway. I don't want that. Plus, if I'm trying to play the game, I don't pay attention to how the game is going from the point of view of design. But I try to, and so I don't play the game very well, so I don't do either very well. And I would rather watch than play. But I'm an odd person. I don't play any games but my own. And I would rather watch a game sometimes than play it, because I can get more from watching than playing. But other people have different points of view. Some people want to play their own games, and, you know, whatever works. There's lots and lots of different ways to do it. Matt likes to say that he's only working on like half a dozen things at a time. Well, I've got 50 or 60. And, you know, some of those will never see the light of day in any significant way, and some of them will. Who knows? But he likes deadlines because he's a procrastinator, and a deadline makes him stop procrastinating. Maybe I'm a procrastinator, but I don't like deadlines, so I tend to have things go on and on and on. But that's all right. It's a hobby for me. It's a business for him. He's got to do it. He's got to make money. I don't have to. I want to come up with a good game and make sure that it ends up being published as a good game. It's not uncommon for games to be followed up by the publishers, as I've said, and even well-known designers like Martin Wallace and so on can tell you stories about games that got published that they were not happy about. And different publishers have different points of view. GMT, for example, they'll tell you up front, the game is your game. We're not going to change it unless you agree. So you have a reasonable dialogue with the developer. Typically, when you have designed a game and you submit it to a company and they're willing to work on it, they assign somebody who the company has hired to be the developer, who may or may not change the game, and will find, you know, kind of like a super-duper playtester for you. Other companies feel that they know what they're doing, and they're willing to change things. Some companies are very bad about changing things and not playtesting the changes. And if you have much experience in designing games, you know every time you change something, there are unintended consequences, unless it's a very small change. So, do we want to deal with these unintended consequences and make sure that they don't cause big problems, or do we just ignore it? Fantasy Flight Games, for example, has a reputation for not playtesting their games very well, and their games tend not to work very well until they come out with a patch. I mean, the first expansion. You know, in video games, usually they don't run so well until you have the first patch. PC games, of course, you can't patch the stuff on the consoles. And I know in the case of Britannia, they rewrote the rules to a sequence of play format as opposed to an older, let's read all the rules and then play the game. Sequence of play is let's try to learn the rules while we play the game, which is how people do it nowadays. And they did a good job, but they didn't test them. And I said at the time, and they were under a big deadline for some reason, I don't know why. I said at the time, you know, I can send these rules to a few people who know the rules even better than I do. My own game, but there are other people who know the rules better. And we probably find some more problems than I had found, because I had found some, and I didn't get a reply. And the result was, there are screw-ups in the rules, and so now they've been revised. Now, the screw-ups were taken care of by an errata sheet, you know, but you don't want to have an errata sheet. So now that's all being combined together. Well, even then, they wrote to me and said, we got a week to revise the rules. But this time, they'd learned something. They said, go ahead and send them to other people, and I did, and they found lots of things, and I found some, and so maybe we did it right this time. But still, a week is ridiculous. You can't play those rules much. All you can do is read them and hope that you know enough to spot things. I don't know why they do that. It's a bad idea, but and other companies will not rush. But Fantasy Flight's a big company, and they make lots of money, so, you know, they've got something going for them. Some companies are marketing companies, and I'd say Fantasy Flight's probably a marketing company. And some companies are strictly gamers companies like GMT. But Fantasy Flight sells a lot more games. And if they sell a lot more games, you'll make a lot more money. But they tend not to take outside contributions. You know, Matt was saying, look at the company's catalog to see what they publish. Well, I have a website, and I said on the website I was revising Britannia to be published again after 25 years. And the owner of Fantasy Flight wrote to me and said, I want to publish your game. I tried to talk him out of it because I looked at their catalog and they had no historical games. The closest was something called Senator, which was, I think, by Knizia, and is typically, you know, there was no history to speak of in it. Well, I failed to talk him out of it, which was good. but the result is that they've got this game, Britannia, that has nothing to do with their normal catalog. Well, since then, they've come out with Tide of Iron, which is another historical game, more or less, so maybe they wanted to get into historical games. I don't know. But that's an example where the company published a game that did not fit their catalog. Why? Because the owner likes the game. Pure and simple. He likes the game. And you'll find that game companies are small enough that that's the way they have to go by. GMT, the people who acquire games for GMT, do not particularly like Britannia. So they're not interested in games of that type. It's not because they don't think they're not good or not won't sell, but they want to publish games that they like. Fair enough. It's almost a hobby for them. Because those are the guys who have full-time jobs. So there's a lot of chance. It's true in publishing of novels. It's true in any kind of publishing. There's an awful lot of chance as to whether they'll want to take your thing. If you'd done it 2 years before or 2 years later, they might say, yeah, but now, no. Because of circumstances. Circumstances completely beyond your control. In other words, you may have an A-plus game, but that doesn't mean they're going to be interested in it. First of all, they don't know it's an A-plus game. They can't tell. How many people have ever heard of Twilight Struggle? Not too many. It's a game that GMT published that turned out to be very, very popular with a not normal GMT crowd. So they're selling a lot of them. They knew that they liked the game, but they had no idea it was going to sell so well. Even the people with a great deal of experience cannot tell how a game is going to sell. And it may be different from one time to another. Many of you heard of a computer game called The Sims, and there's several spin-offs. Apparently, a few years before The Sims came out, there was a game called Little Computer People or something like that that did essentially the same thing, but didn't go anywhere. It just wasn't the right time. So, recognize that there's an awful lot of chance and that a rejection does not reflect upon you or does not reflect upon your game necessarily. It's just a matter of what the company particularly is interested in at the time. The Lord of the Rings was rejected a great many times, I understand. The book, before it was published. And it's the best-selling book in English language, I think, other than the Bible.
Was that the first Harry Potter book, too, that they got rejected by a lot of publishers?
Mm-hmm.
You gotta wonder, what were they thinking?
Well,
Star Wars was rejected several times, the movie proposal.
Well, you don't doubt it, because the proposal, when I first heard about it, I said, oh God, sounds like another B-junkie movie, but it turned out to be quite good. It's still dumb. Star Wars is dumb. It doesn't make sense, but, you know, it's fun, and people like to watch it, and I like to watch it, but, you know, most action movies nowadays are dumb, with holes, plot holes big enough to drive a truck through, but people don't care. And they care less now than they did 25 years ago when Star Wars first came out. But certainly the point is, you don't know, they don't know, there's an awful lot of chance. And so persistence counts for a great deal. A great deal. Back in the early 80s, I had four games that I thought were really good. The only one that got published was Britannia. The other three have not been published to this day. Will they be? I don't know. One's a science fiction game, one's a fantasy game, and they're not very popular as board games these days, so maybe not. But was I right? I don't know. I was right about one of them. But you don't know. When I talk to a publisher, I tell them, designers can't really judge. You have to judge from the playtesters. So I was talking to one gang yesterday about a game, and I said, I have had people that I don't know play this game, and before they're even done, they said, I'll buy this game. So guess maybe it's pretty good. Maybe. Don't know. Because that's very rare. People just volunteer that, yeah, I'll buy this game. Very rare. At least when I'm playtesting things. So, lots of people get ideas. Fewer try to go from the general idea to the specific game idea. A lot of it is, oh, I have this great idea for a game. And you sit somebody down and say, okay, describe the game to me. They find out that they don't really know what they're talking about. They have a vague idea, but they haven't put it into game terms. I have this for my students. Oh yeah, this is going to be a good video game. Describe it. They can't. Send them away. Write it down. You have to write things down. I believe that you should write down every idea you've got. I have a notebook with me. That I write things down in. Now, for fear I'm going to lose this notebook, I transfer it to a computer as soon as possible and I back it up. And I'm a computer guy in the real world. I also carry my Star Trek communicator, and it's a voice recorder. I carry this with me virtually all the time. So if there's something I want to remind myself of, I talk to this and I say, this is my memory. I plunk it into the cradle, I listen to it on a computer, I take care of things. Or I write it down, whatever. You got to write things down, because otherwise the idea will go away, and it's very annoying. Last night, I was tired, and I had an idea, and I went and got this to talk to it, but I said, oh, I'll finish doing what I was doing in the bathroom, and by then I'd forgotten it. Oh, that was annoying. And yeah, I'm 56 years old, but I actually have quite a good memory. Nonetheless, I want to write it down. Because one of the things you can do is, if you don't feel very productive, go look at your old ideas. A lot of designing a game is associating ideas. And you might find, well, I'll put this idea to this together. That's something new. This is cool. And you might have thought of this a year ago, and you might have thought of this 2 years ago. You don't know. So I have a program called InfoSelect, which is fairly obscure. It's a free text database that I have on my computer, and I have all the ideas and all the information in there. And then I have a directory on my computer called LuGames, where I store all the maps that I save and download rules that I read, because I read lots of rules for games. I don't play games, but I read lots of rules, and I watch people play a lot. And it all works its way together. Anyway, to go back, we have lots of people get ideas, fewer go from the general to the specific, fewer yet try to produce a prototype. Fewer yet produce a decently playable prototype. You know, you can produce a prototype, and when you play, you find out, oh, it's blah. Very few produce a complete game. So the rules are complete and you can give it to somebody and they can play it without you telling them what to do. And then very, very few produce a good complete game. So you have to put some effort into it and recognize that ideas alone don't get you anywhere. The manufacturers would love to have a game given to them that was absolutely complete. I've heard of one case where a designer did all the artwork for a game, because they were professional artists. They were familiar with that kind of thing. But generally, the manufacturer will do the art, and they will decide how to do things, and you will have very little influence. Um, sometimes you can tell them what you think the pieces ought to be like, and they'll use it. So in Britannia, the pieces, this version of Britannia, they don't have words on them, which is a desirable thing nowadays because they want to sell in foreign languages. If there's no words, they don't have to worry about it. They have symbols, and those symbols are a lot easier to see than the words that were on the original Britannia pieces. So it becomes more practical. It's also easier to do variants where you switch the pieces around and so on. So that was an idea that I had that I gave them, and they followed through. On the other hand, they made other changes. And this is an example of how manufacturers have their own agendas and requirements. Evidently, Fantasy Flight feels that they should never make a player keep records, have to write something down, which is quite a reasonable objective nowadays when you come down to it. So, Britannia is a game where people use a score sheet and they write the scores down every third or fourth turn and they tally it up and that's who wins. They didn't include a score sheet. They were going to put a scoring track around in typical Eurogame style, and I said, this is a four-hour game, five-hour game. That's not going to work. People are going to bump it. They're going to knock it off. No, bad idea. And they said, okay, we're going to put scoring pieces with it. So they put little round scoring markers, ones and fives and 25s, large numbers of them, which increased their costs. Or it would appear that it increased their costs. Who knows? They ended up with four counter sheets, and I think they do them in sets of two, so maybe they had the room for it. But those pieces are there, and that's what people use until they find out there's a score sheet, and then most of them use a score sheet. Nonetheless, nobody's forced to write anything down. And actually, the pieces are good because if the players agree not to keep track of the score separately, then you're not quite sure what the score is, and that makes the game a little bit different. So those changes were made by the manufacturer. The manufacturer does the art. They may send you things that show what the art looks like, or they may not. You could have a game published and not know what it's going to look like until it's published. The manufacturer is the expert on the production side, not the designer. Let's see. When you submit a game, in other words, you've sent a proposal and they say, yeah, you know, let's look at it. Expect it to take a long time for them to decide what to do, and expect it then to take a long time to be published. And I mean a long time. It won't always be this way. When I started to revise Britannia, which was only a revision, mind you, it's not a new game, to the time it was published was 3 years. Now, I'm sure there are exceptions and things happen in a year, but many of the bigger manufacturers schedule more than a year ahead. So they could get your game right now, and they can't even schedule it until more than a year from now, even if they're confident that they're going to do it as soon as they can. Patience is a virtue, in other words. The printing is often done in Germany or in China. It takes a long time to ship. They ship them by boat. In the case of Britannia, the game became available in Eastern Europe in December of 2005. No, not December. Maybe November, maybe even earlier. It didn't actually arrive in Minnesota until after Christmas. So what happened was they took some from the printer and distributed them in Europe because it was printed in Germany. And then what happened was they had an insert in the game that was cardboard, and it was too tall, so the box would not close all the way. Well, that meant the boxes wouldn't fit in their standard shipping boxes because Fantasy Flight has standard box sizes. So they waited until the end of February to take that out in all those copies and put in a different plastic insert from another game, which puzzles the heck out of people because the holes in it don't fit the pieces at all. And then they issued the game. So completely unanticipated, a delay of a couple of months. You never know what's going to happen. So, patience is a virtue. And, of course, Matt can't be patient, but he has been at this long enough and has enough pull that, and he's also doing role-playing games, which are much easier to produce because they're just printing, many of them. that he probably doesn't run into that kind of trouble. Now, he has run into people not paying him. And he said in the previous version of this seminar that the best place to collect is right here, about Saturday night, when the manufacturers have got a lot of money from selling things and they're feeling pretty good, and that's when he goes and hits them up for the money. Now, I had one game published, Dragon Rage, which sold very well, but I never got a dime for it. It was published by a subsidiary of Heritage Models, which was Duke Seyfried. And Duke is kind of an irascible fellow. He got in a spitting contest with his lawyer about things having to do with the models, that is, the miniature figures. And the lawyer called in a loan, and the company collapsed. So all those games were sold, but I never made a dime off it. And even the plates that were used to produce, the printer held, because the printer hadn't been paid. So when it came time to liquidate the company, they couldn't sell the game somewhere else and get it reprinted again because the plates, which are very expensive, were with the printer. So that kind of thing can happen too. You know, Eagle Games, I think we already mentioned, Eagle Games collapsed for reasons not having to do, they say, with their games. They put too much money into poker software, and that was dumb because poker software is easy to produce. They had to have, if they'd been thinking about it, they would have realized this is a market that's going away soon because there'll be free programs. And there were, and so who's going to buy a commercial one? And poof, they were gone. A company that was very visible, produced lots of big games and so on. So you never know what's going to happen. And any business that can happen, you can have a book published and the book publisher then goes kaput. It's not as likely, but it can happen. Almost anything you do in business, if you do work for somebody and then they then go bankrupt, you're not going to get paid. Art versus science. This is a topic that comes up. And at 2 o'clock, as I said, we're going to talk about the process of designing a game, nuts and bolts, which you can't get in books, interestingly enough. The books about designing games are almost all about video games, and they talk about a whole lot of things that don't actually have to do with game design, and they analyze games a lot, but they don't actually tell you things so that when you get done you can say, okay, I'm going to design a game, I'm going to do this, this, and this. Well, that's what I'm going to try to do at 2 o'clock, and the reason why I passed around those forms for names is I hope to write a book that does the same sort of thing, and I will then send everybody who's given me this name a notice that I've written the book and how they can get hold of it. Because there's very, very much a need for a how-to book. So that you said step by step. Now, that doesn't mean everybody's going to do it that way, but some framework has to be provided. And that's what I'm going to try to do at 2 o'clock. So I can talk a little bit about it here in the time we have left. But the main talking about the actual process will be at 2 o'clock. Well, art versus science. This is an argument that you see all over, and it's cloaked in different names, Apollonian and Dionysian and Romantic and Classical and art and science and so on. But what this amounts to is how much of game design is from the gut and just feeling, and how much of it is something that you can plan or that you can organize. Well, I take my point of view from Thomas Edison, who said success is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. A lot of the process of doing a game is work. Now, it may be enjoyable work, but it's work. It's not, I'm going to be creative. Creativity is important. But in the execution of a game, there's a lot that you might call a craft or a science. And that's why playtesting is very important, because that's where you get to see the results of your science and modify further. But if you don't have any creativity there, it still might not amount to much of a game. It might not be very enjoyable. Matt talked about a game that he designed, a card game, where he was supposed to take the essence of poker and turn it into a game with a particular theme for some property or other. He said he did that, and they played it, and it was actually absolutely dull. You know, when you're assigned to do a game on a particular theme, then your creativity is in some sense limited, and sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. So what they then decided to do was figure out what parts of poker they wanted to incorporate and redo the game from scratch, and then they had a good game. So, creativity is important, but even creativity is something that you make happen. You know, people say, where do you get ideas? Well, ideas come from a lot of places, but the most important thing is that you have to sit down and say, I'm going to create ideas. You don't wait for them to float through the ether and come into your head. Because occasionally they will, especially in the shower. For me, anyway. Matt mentioned the shower too, actually. But you're going to get a lot more if you say, I am going to do this. So periodically I say, I'm going to design a game. And by that I don't mean go all the way, but I'm going to get the basic idea and so on and write it down. And was it last weekend? I don't know. Recently I decided to do that and came up with two new games. Now, will I get them to the point of prototypes? I don't know. What now I have is a couple of pages of notes in this book, which, sinful me, I've been too tired to put into the computer. I will tonight. But if I hadn't sat down and said, I'm going to do this, it wouldn't have happened. Now, a good place to do this is when you're driving a vehicle in easy driving circumstances, like on the interstate. Don't be doing it when you're trying to drive through a city or something, because it will distract you, and if you're distracted, you're more likely to get in an accident. But you can think about it, and can't write things down, I talk to this. Or I talk to this, which is recording what we're doing. This is an MP3 player. And then you've got a record of it, and you can put it into the computer and have it there to look at later and decide what to do with. But if you don't make the effort to get the ideas to start with, it's not going to happen. Now, where do ideas come from? Well, ideas come from everything you do and everything you are. Anything you read can be ideas for games. Any game you play can be ideas for games. Any game you just read the rules of can be ideas for games. You want to think of ways to juxtapose different things or put things into circumstances that are unusual. And you might come up with something or you might not. And if you think there's any possibility you'll come up with something, write it down. Talk to people about games. Speculate. I know in the case of science fiction authors, they ask odd questions about things we take for granted. What if it wasn't like this? What if it was something else? And that can give them ideas for novels. And your typical novelist, who's a full-time novelist, has more ideas for novels than they can ever do. Just as even me, who is a part-time game designer, I have far more game ideas than I can ever do. There's just not time. Not to maintain a normal life. But you've got to work at it. Way back when, around 1980, I wrote a lot of articles for Dragon magazine. I had lots and lots and lots of ideas, and at that point, not having a computer, I wrote them down on 3x5 cards. I still got them. And I had far more ideas than I could write the articles. But when I stopped that, the ideas went away. There were no ideas of that sort because I wasn't thinking about it. When I got back into game designing in 2003, 2004, I started to think about things, and now there's bunches of ideas that I can't possibly deal with. So, getting ideas is not or should not be a problem as long as you put effort into it. And you recognize that, okay, I've got an idea, but it doesn't mean anything until I turn it into a game. But if you don't have ideas, you can't turn them into games. I am not good about actually submitting my games to people. I tend to want to hold on to them. I'm worried about them being screwed up. Old man. But I keep track of things. Like when I get an idea for a game that I think, well, this is a big idea, I write it down, and I try to do at least one a month. And I actually keep a record. And I keep a record of when I first play a game. I keep a record of when I first play it with other people. I keep a record of when I write a rough set of rules. I keep a record of when I write a full set of rules. And I can look at the past 6 months and say, have I written some full sets of rules here? If I haven't, I'm not doing my job. Because writing full sets of rules is the hardest thing people will misunderstand constantly. It's the hardest thing for me, certainly. It may not be the hardest thing for a lot of people. If you're doing role-playing games, then precision is impossible because the rules are so long. So it's a different kettle of fish. But for a board game, you've got to be absolutely precise. And it's so easy for people to misunderstand. If you have a game that's well-known like Britannia, I get questions from people, email messages that are way out in left field. Everybody knows it's this way. And one guy says, well, I think it's this way. Where did he get that idea? He misread something. You have to work at writing the rules so that people won't get those oddball ideas, so they're less likely to get those oddball ideas. Anyway, I keep track of these things, and I also keep track of how many games I have in a year that are played by other people, how many games that I play solo that have not been played by other people, and in how many games I've done something else with that aren't in the first two categories. And it comes out to about 15 played by other people, about 10-15 played solo, and about 20 that I've done something else with. Now some of those games, many of those games, most of those games will never see the light of day. I have got to the point where I have played a prototype several times and then have not touched it for years and may never again. It just wasn't good enough. I've got to the point where I've had other people play and I said, well, this just isn't working the way it was when I was playing it. And sometimes that's it for that. It's probably not very often the case that I play the game solo and say, this isn't going to go. I've got to see other people perhaps play it and then say, this isn't going to go. Alan Moon, I believe it was Alan Moon, said he felt at least 60% of the games he designed never made it. He would give up for one reason or another. And of course, you may store one of those away and 5 years later look at it. I have games. I play this with a lot of young people because I'm a teacher. And I like to bring out a game and say, this game hasn't been played since you were 2 years old. Because it's 25 years ago. So I've dragged out some of those ones, but I've not submitted any of those old ones anyway. Because they tend to be a different... People were more willing to work at a game then than they are now. For example, I have one game that's quite good where you keep your pieces upside down so the other player doesn't know what you've got. But that means you have to look at them and keep track. People don't want to do that anymore. 25 years ago, that was okay. Now, that's too much hassle. People want games, everything to be really easy. I'm talking about young people. By and large, not everybody. But so games are different now than they were 25 years ago. But you have to be productive. Matt's method of being productive is he gets deadlines and he goes on deadlines. He tells a story, which I'll tell since he's not here. He has written 3 or 4 books for Blood Bowl, which is a game. And he'd agreed to write the 3rd one in the series, I think. He got a call from the editor and said, well, how you doing on that book? Oh, when's it due? 2 weeks. He hadn't even started it. 2 weeks, and it was coming up to Thanksgiving. So he said, can you give me 2.5 so I can spend some time with my family? Yeah. He wrote that book in 2 weeks. The last day he wrote 11,000 words. Now, how much is that? A double-spaced computer-printed page generates 250 words, roughly speaking. So that's 44 double-spaced pages written and revised. Michael Moorcock wrote a book once in 36 hours. He's a very well-known science fiction fantasy author. One of the Hawk Moon series. 36 hours. Now, he probably revised it after that, but you can do those things if you sit down and go to it. And, you know, some people are dynamos. Matt's a dynamo when it comes to writing. He used to aim for 5,000 words a day. And a lot of that was game rules and you can only do that in fantasy. You can't do that in board games because the board game rules have to be very specific. And in role-playing stuff, once again, you can do a more general coverage because people are going to take the role-playing game and do what they want with it anyway. And, you know, sometimes it happens with a board game, but you don't really want it to happen with a board game. You don't want people playing differently than it was intended, because if you've done a good job of designing it and they don't play it the way it was supposed to be played, it's probably going to be worse. Not necessarily, though. There are many things when you get to the end of production of a board game, of design of a board game and development, where it's pretty much an arbitrary decision which way you go. Six of one, half a dozen of the other. We'll do it this way. Well, if somebody does it the other way, it's not going to harm the game particularly. But there are things that, you know, people screw them up and it'll really mess the game up. So you want to make those rules very clear. And that is hard. Any kind of writing is hard. And people like Matt will tell you that. And Dave Duncan, who's a Canadian science fiction author, he's wrote 33 books. And he said, writing is really hard work. After 33 books. But then his previous job was working in the oil industry, so maybe that was hard work too. And he was in his 40s or 50s when he started to write science fiction. So you don't have to be a young person to get into something new. It may help in some cases, or it may not. There are actually not many authors of novels who are young people. That's something where life experience tends to make a difference. Games, I don't think that's true. Young, old, it doesn't seem to matter. When you're designing a game, you need to choose some limits. The first limit is, who is your audience? Anything you write, anything you design, you have to figure out who the audience is first, because that's going to help determine what you do. If you're doing a game for wargamers, crotchety old guys who are wargamers, then you can do a different game than if you're designing a game for people who are 15 to 25. Because they have very different points of view. They have very different things that they're interested in. And there are lots of related questions, like, do you want the game to be short or long? Do you want it to have a lot of chance or a little chance? Do you want to have lots of story or not much story? Do you want it to be a ruthless game or a nice game? Do you want it to be simple or complex? These are things you have to decide pretty early on. There's no perfect game. What's a good game for one person is not for another. How many people here like Settlers of Catan? I bought Settlers of Catan some years ago to see what it was all about, and I read the rules and I said, oh, that's nice. I have no earthly urge to play that game. None. Some people love it. Britannia is a very long game, 4 to 5 hours. Very long by current standards. I know people who played it 500 times. I'm in awe of that. I haven't played it 500 times. And these are busy people with families, but that's what they like to do. So, and yet a lot of people say, oh, it's too long, I'd never do that. So there's no perfect game. You're aiming at a particular audience. And if you haven't figured out what your audience is, how are you going to decide what to do? I don't know. There's also genre that you can choose, especially if you're doing a video game, but you might want a particular kind of game. The genres are not as clear in board games as they are in video games. You know, in video games, you have first-person shooters, and you have action games, and you have real-time strategy games, and you've got simulation games, and so on. We don't have those kinds of strong categories, but we certainly have collectible card game, role-playing game, board game, non-collectible card game, and so on. And you have to decide pretty early on what kind of game you want to do. Some games you don't want to bother with. Collectible card games, forget it. It costs too much money to get it going. $1 million, probably. Unless you already have a contract with somebody. Even after you've decided all those things, you still want to have limits. Insofar as games are like art, then we can consider that in art, there are periods where there are rules that people are supposed to follow. And then they're succeeded by periods when the rules sort of fall apart until a new set of rules are devised. And this can take generations. In the case of music, the great music comes when the rules are set. And then you have people who sometimes go beyond those rules, but they do in certain ways. Beethoven certainly broke a lot of rules. Bach followed the rules, except he would occasionally deviate from it, and that was his best stuff, frequently. Then following Bach, you know, Bach's sons and so on, you can't name a lot of great music from that period. Then you have Haydn and Mozart, where the rules were set again. Haydn had a lot to do with it. And so on and so forth. You get to 12-tone music and things like that, where they're trying to establish new rules and you don't have a lot of great music. The same is true in art. You know, modern art, where you just do any old thing, well, that's all crap as far as I'm concerned, and I may be wrong in the long run, but it's a case of there are no rules, and usually you don't get great works. Now, that's applying that to the game industry. If you have not set some limits for what you're doing, then you may not get much of anything out of it. So, self-imposed limits can be very useful. You have your own preferences, I'm sure, but you may impose ones. Like, for some years, I have been attempting to design the one-hour war game, which is very difficult for a multiplayer game. And I've gone through essentially four, and I have finally got there. The other ones were all more two hours or so, and they're all quite good. But they didn't quite make the one-hour war game. But the quest for it made me simplify. And it's very important nowadays to simplify, because that's what people, especially younger people, like, is simple things, not complex things. It's a consequence of the PlayStation generation and TV and a lot of other, internet and a lot of other things. Euro games, for example, which tend to be quite popular, also tend to be quite simple. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So, you set your limits for yourself, and then you do it. You know, a lot of people think about doing something and they don't do it. You know, we've got like 1 minute left here, so I guess I can end with this. You have to do it, not think about it. If you don't get the playable prototype, you're just a dilettante. You're just playing around. You're not really doing it. And, you know, if that suits you, that's just fine. But if you want to be somebody who designs games, you have to design games. You have to do it on a fairly regular basis. You have to produce something that people can play. You have to play it yourself. Even if you never have anybody else play it, at least you play it yourself and you know that there is or maybe isn't something there. If there isn't, then you go on and do another one. And the more practice you get, the better you'll get at it. If you get other people to play it, that's even better. But you've got to play the game. If you haven't played a game, you haven't done anything. And there's tons of people, especially teenagers, oh, I want to be a game designer. They don't do anything about it. They just say, I want to be a game designer, and somehow it's going to happen. It's not just going to happen. You have to decide to do something about it, and then spend the time and get a result and be able to show that result. There's no way around it. Any questions?
There's a thing called a toy and game something that's going to be Mr. Cool. TGIF Con or something like that. Is that a way to
play? Oh, I have not heard of it. Oh, one of them, huh?
One of them.
So what are you supposed to do? You pay them and then what?
Some sort of convention.
If it's the same one that I know about, cover up my eyes, cover up the TGIF. If it's the same one, TGIF is the common name.
Yeah. There are companies that say they'll evaluate your game and develop it, but that's crap. They won't do anything significant, and there's no reason to believe they'd be doing any better than anybody else, you know.
Get your prototype, send your submission by the guidelines, and then when they respond, then send the prototype.
they want to see it. I can tell you that the reason I'm here mainly is to talk to publishers. Yesterday I showed, and I showed them physically what the thing was and talked about it. We didn't play the game. I showed 4 games to 3 different publishers. And I left one with one to evaluate overnight, essentially, to at least see if they were going to deal with it. And in another case, I'll send in the PDFs of the files. In another case, I left him, it was a card game, I left him that to evaluate. And the other one, I haven't played it enough that I wanted to leave him anything. So coming to a convention like this is actually the best way to get in touch with the publishers and get somewhere. But even there, I can walk up and they know who I am. I'm not famous, but I'm semi-famous in this small context. You know, Matt's famous in a role-playing game context. If he gets over in the board game side, I don't know. If Matt went to GMT, if they'd have any idea who he was, I don't know. So even within the industry, there's places where you're known and where you're not known. But I wrote to them first, emailed them, and talked with them, and then agreed to meet them at Origins. Really, if you're a person that has no track record in the industry, it's going to be pretty hard to get noticed. Because, you know, all the manufacturers run into all these people who think they have great ideas and think they have wonderful design, they got diddly squat. They don't want to mess with that. It's a waste of their time. That's why I say volunteering at booths, writing articles, publishing variants, even just having a website where you publish free variants of things, that's a way to get noticed, possibly. Because you've done something. You're not just somebody coming out of the blue. You know, the video game companies, a lot of them, who do they hire? They don't hire people out of school, even people who've taken video game curricula. They hire people who've already worked in the industry, or they hire people who've made mods that have done very well. In other words, a mod where you've modified a game and it's out there and people play it, those are the people they want to hire because they've done something. So if you've done something, you're much more likely to get noticed. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing, but... Well, not necessarily, but put yourself in the position of a publisher who gets a message from somebody they've heard of and gets another message from somebody they haven't. Who are they going to deal with first? Who are they going to rely on more? It's a big problem. It's a big problem getting in. And Matt says that what he did was he volunteered at booths at conventions. And that's the way he got to know people. And once they knew who he was, if he said, I've got this idea for doing something, they'll pay attention to him. But if somebody just walked up to that booth and said, I got this great idea for a game, you yawn. That's reality.
I mean, does it help the... have the game?
Even if you have the game, do they want to take the time to look at it? Having the game might be good, because at least they know you've produced a game, but it's still a case of who are you? Why should I bother? Why should I spend my time? It's a hard reality. You know, when you hire a plumber, they're in the phone book probably, and you might know people who, you know, they're a plumber. If somebody just comes up and says, I'm a plumber and I want to fix your pipes, you don't want to know. So if somebody comes up and says, I'm a game designer and I got this game, they want to deal with the people they know are game designers first, naturally. But if you volunteered at their booth, they know who you are. If you've published articles, you can say, well, you know, I have had the article published in Against the Odds magazine or something like that. There are a few magazines still that publish things. Or you can say, well, I've had this stuff published at such a game site, maybe then they're a little more likely to deal with you. But there again, if you email them first, you can get a notion. If you describe your game, maybe they'll think it's wonderful. If you just walk up there, they're busy. So, email the companies, you know, first of all, look at their websites and see what they say about submissions. Email them, ask them if they would like to see a description of a game that you've designed and that you had X number of people play test. They want to know things like that. Because so many games people produce and they have their friends play test them and their friends are polite and say it's good and it's not. And then they think they got a great game and they got a piece of junk. Oh yeah, I've had 25 people play test this game. Then, who knows, they might be interested. I don't think I said in this version, I actually had an agent the first time I had a game published. I was in London working on my doctoral dissertation. And I knew a guy who published a game magazine there. And I didn't know a lot about it, so I used him as an agent to get me to one of the big game publishers, Gibson's at that time. And they published the game. Gibson's later published Britannia, but I didn't use an agent then. I just went to him directly. But at that time, I was writing articles for the magazine, and I'd written articles for other magazines. I'd written a lot of diplomacy variants and so on. And so there was something there to say, Lewis knows some of these things as an expert in D&D and so on, that the agent could then convey to the publisher. I wasn't an unknown quantity. That's always the problem. If you're an unknown quantity, why should they bother with you? It's frustrating as all hell, but that's the way it is.
It almost sounds like maybe self-publishing something on a small scale.
Sometimes that works. People have self-published things and then they've been picked up by somebody else. Because then if you've sold it, that shows that, you know, something happened. Some people wanted to buy it.
I've been to a con. I've sold 200 copies of this game. I've got other people who you know, bought it. And, you know, this is what I think we can do with it.
Mm-hmm. Self-publishing is relatively easy nowadays. You could self-publish something and then try to publicize it on BoardGameGeek. See if people play it. See if somebody will review it, you know. That might get you somewhere. But if you don't have any track record, then it's just hard to get their attention because they're busy people. They're not making a lot of money at what they're doing, the publishers, and so why bother with you?
I'm
that's
how things are.
Yeah, it's just the way it is. We probably have to abandon the room here quite soon. There'll probably be somebody else in here.
Staff seem daring to sold like on eBay for different games, I guess another way.
Ah, that's
like
interesting.
Like B-17, I've seen variant card sets sold or variant maps.
That's an idea I hadn't thought of. Oh, no, you were quite right.